Come now, begin delving, the bell is obtained. The contest was hard, but a conquest is gain. Let no time be lost, time to get business done. Set thousands to work that work down the sun. With speed the desirable work to complete, the whole power learning the spirit how great. By seven we soon, I've no doubt in me mind, with old Father Ten shall an intercourse find. So does the rate for canals seem to grow, that vessels accustomed to Bristol to go will soon be deserting Sabrina's fair tide, the shallows and shoals sailors wish to avoid. As freedom I prize and my country respect, I trust not a soul to my toast will object. Success to the plough, not forgetting the spade, of plenty and peace, navigation and trade. Delving, the bell is obtained. The contest was hard, but a conquest is gain. Let no time be lost, and to get business done, set thousands to work that work down the sun.
Set thousands to work that work down the sun. And so they did. Between them, the Duke of Bridgewater and Brindley, the millwright turned canal engineer, revolutionized inland transport in this country, and in so doing provided considerable impetus for the Industrial Revolution, as well as work for the poor and sound investment for the rich. Well, mainly sound investment, since the age of canal building also had its South Sea bubble moments. Before this mania struck, the writers of the day were busy sowing the seeds for it by heaping praise and good testimony on the builders of the Worsley Canal, completed in 1761.
The canal of the great Duke of Bridgewater, who may justly be called the parent and founder of all similar works in this kingdom, is a very striking instance of public utility. And no doubt the vast fortune which this noble adventurer thus sacrificed for the good of his country, at a time of life when others squander their patrimony in useless dissipation, will amply be repaid.
So reported the Reverend Shaw in 1788. And the following year, an anonymous traveller informed the public,
"'Tis not long since I viewed the artificial curiosities of London, and now have seen the natural wonders of the Peak. But none of them have given me so much pleasure as I now receive in surveying the Duke of Bridgewater's navigation in this country. His projector, the ingenious Mr. Brindley, has indeed made such improvements in this way as are truly astonishing. At Barton Bridge, he has erected a navigable canal in the air, for it is as high as the tops of the trees."
But the grand visions and eloquent words of the canal financiers and engineers would have come to little had it not been for the legions of anonymous canal-digging navvies, whose passage through the country left an indelible mark upon economic and social life during the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Later in the 19th century, these men and their heirs produced a similarly remarkable effect when they helped build the railways. In the early days of canal digging, labour was attained locally, and over a period of years, an experienced and trained body of men became available for the work. Brindley played an instrumental part in the development of this corps.
Brindley did not want for good men to carry out his plans. He found plenty of labourers in the neighbourhood accustomed to hard work, who speedily became expert excavators. And though there was at first a lack of skilled carpenters, blacksmiths, and bricklayers, they soon became trained into such under the vigilant eye of so able a master as Brindley was.
Rather than train a new body of workmen for each canal, the engineers often found it easier to employ the established workmen, and eventually a very large, highly mobile, and experienced workforce was at the disposal of the canal builders. These travelling men from Ireland, Scotland, Yorkshire, Lancashire, and so on, expected to earn a good livelihood in return for hard work. Some saved their money and became regular contractors employing their own gangs on the navigation, whilst others, less keen on such hard work, might dream of marrying the boss's daughter.
Oh, when I was young and tender, I left my native home, and often to old Scotland I started out to roam. Oh, I started out to roam. Oh, as I walked down through Bishopstown, seeking for employ, oh, the ganger he knew by me, I was a navvy boy. Oh, I was a navvy boy. As soon as I did get employ, for lodgings I did seek. Oh, it happened to be that very, very night at the ganger's I did sleep. At the ganger's I did sleep. Oh, he had one only daughter dear, and I became her joy. For she longed to go and a trumpet with him, her own dear navvy boy, with her own dear navvy boy. This, her father died, I'm told, my and left unto his daughter dear £500 in the gold, £500 in the gold. And when she got me money, soon I became her joy. For she longed to go and a trumpet with her own dear navvy boy, with her own dear navvy boy.
During the late 18th and early 19th centuries, there were thousands of canal navvies, or banditti as they were commonly called, moving about the country. The resultant social upheaval was devastating. The villages and towns they left behind were frequently stripped of their young men, and the places they travelled to were totally unprepared for such influxes of outsiders.
In the making of canals, it is the general custom to employ gangs of hands who travel from one work to another and do nothing else. These banditti, known in some parts of England by the name of navvies or navigators, and in others by that of bankers, are generally the terror of the surrounding country. They are as completely a class by themselves as the gypsies, possessed of all the daring recklessness of the smuggler without any of his redeeming qualities. Their ferocious behaviour can only be equalled by the brutality of their language. From being long known to each other, they in general act in concert and put at defiance any local constabulary force. Consequently, crimes of the most atrocious character are common, and robbery, without any attempt at concealment, has been an everyday occurrence wherever they have been congregated in large numbers.
LeCount, who was closely involved in the planning of the first railways, was attempting to prevent their construction having the same system of employment as the canals. And the evidence of other contemporaries, newspapers and canal company records, shows that his account was by no means wildly exaggerated. The following letter was sent by the Lancaster Canal Company to the contractors, Vickers and Lewis, in July 1795.
I am sorry to be informed that some of your men have been behaving in riotous and very illegal manner at Chorley. Such conduct will bring disgrace upon the works, as well as upon yourselves, and every appearance ought to meet with an immediate and serious check. You will probably be called upon by the justices in the neighbourhood to deliver up the persons who have been guilty, and I would advise you to show the utmost willingness in detecting and bringing them to justice, and be ready to do everything in your power which may be required to satisfy the public for the injury done in thus disturbing the peace and assaulting the public officers. This conduct in you will please the committee, and it is certainly in your own interest to keep your men in proper subjection.
Perhaps it is not surprising that the navvies acted as they did. Their work was fraught with hardship and danger that often resulted in injury and death. And those who did not live in the company hut encampments were often cheated by greedy landladies, or the truck system, where payment for work was made by company note, which could only be redeemed at the company shop, where prices were frequently higher and quality frequently lower than those found on the open market. In spite of the sobering influence of the missionary societies, the social life of the majority of navvies revolved round the public house, and most of their serious crimes, like theft, rape and murder, were perpetrated under the influence of drink. The navvies were rootless itinerants, resentful of their lack of home comforts, but well paid enough to enjoy to excess the fringe benefits of society, and, by token of their way of life, sufficiently outside the law to ignore the basic responsibilities of community membership. Strangely, there are few songs that mention the everyday routine of the navvies, and to find one that deals wholly with his day-to-day life and attitudes is a rarity.
On Monday morning we make it a rule for every man to choose his own tool. Three that comes first may choose all the best, and he who comes last may take all the rest. For that's the rule of the bold navigators, for your jovial banks then all. On Tuesday morning when we go to work, we strip off our jackets and tighten our shirts. We strip off our jackets and let them out free. We drive our poles by 1, 2 and 3. For that's the role of the bold navigators, for we are jovial banksmen all. It's when that we come to the bottommost run, we fill up our barrows right unto our chin. We fill up our barrows and pile them up high, and if you don't wheel it, another will try.
Oh, that's the rule of the bold navigators, for we are jovial banksmen all.
It's when that we come to the main plank wheel, we lower our hands and hold fast on our heels. For if the plank does bend or go, a ganger on top cries, look out below!
For that's the rule of the bold navigators, for we are jovial banksmen all.
And when we are struck by frost or snow, we'll blow up our mess and off we will go. We'll call our timekeeper without any dam to let us have our time before we go tramp.
Oh, that's the rule of the bold navigators, for we are jovial banksmen all.
And when that it does begin for to rain, we'll take up our barrows and all gang in. Right into a whiskey shop we will go. We don't give a damn whether we work or no.
For that's the role of the bold navigators, for we are jovial banksmen all.
Gaffer without any damp, we'll not pay his tummy before we go tramp. We'll tell our landlady before we do go that it's not our role to pay what we owe.
That's the role of the bold navigators, for we are jovial banksmen all.
That's the role of the bold navigators, for we are jovial banksmen all.
The navvies were not the only ones who suffered because of their chosen way of life. The engineers, who found fame and fortune in their work, were frequently beset by illnesses which resulted from their itinerant way of life. Brindley, the first British canal engineer of repute, was no exception. The final chapter of his life is best told in the moving words of his friend and mentor, Josiah Wedgwood, when writing to inform Thomas Bentley of Brindley's death.
To Mr. Thomas Bentley, Little China Row, Chelsea, near London, 28th of September, 1772. My dear friend, I told you in my last letter that Mr. Brindley was extremely ill, and I have the grief to tell you he is now no more. He died the 27th instant, about 12 noon, in a sound sleep. What the public has lost can only be conceived by those who best knew his character and talents, talents to which this age and country are indebted for works that will be the most lasting monuments to his fame, and show to future ages how much good may be done by one single genius when happily employed upon works beneficial to mankind. Mr. Brindley had an excellent constitution, but his mind, too ardently intent upon the execution of the works it had planned, wore down a body at the age of 55, which originally promised to have lasted a century, and might have given him the pleasing expectation of living to see those great works completed for which millions yet unborn will revere and bless his memory. Do I need to tell you that he bore his last illness with that fortitude and strength of mind which characterized all his actions? Your affectionate friend, Josiah Wedgwood.
Whatever the hardships of the itinerant navvies, craftsmen and engineers, and whatever their social problems, the canals were built, and their owners were happy to celebrate with a grand opening befitting the magnificence of the occasion. Those who attended such ceremonies and those who stood idly by to watch the building of the canals were known as gongooslers, or, as De Salis expresses it in his Handbook of Inland Navigation,
idle and inquisitive persons who stand staring for prolonged periods at anything out of the common.
Such canal openings provided the opportunity for prolonged gongoozling on an Olympian scale. Naturally, the navvies got their roasted ox and free beer and were allowed to take part in the festivities before going tramp, that is, looking for their next navigation job. Such were the festivities that marked the opening of the Croydon Canal in October 1809, of which the Times newspaper said,
"On Monday last, the navigation of this canal from the Thames to the town of Croydon was opened. The proprietors met at Sydenham and there embarked on one of the company's barges, which was handsomely decorated with flags, etc. At the moment of this barge moving forward, an excellent band played God Save the King, and a salute of 21 guns was fired. The proprietor's barge advanced, followed by a great many barges, loaded some of them with coal, others with stone, corn, etc., etc. When the proprietors approached the basin at Croydon, they saw it surrounded by many thousands of persons, assembled to greet, with thanks and applause, those by whose patriotic perseverance so important a work had been accomplished. It is impossible to describe adequately the scene which presented itself and the feelings which prevailed when the proprietor's barge was entering the basin, at which instant the band was playing God Save the King, the guns were firing, the bells of the church were ringing, and this immense concourse of delighted persons was hailing by universal and hearty and long-continuing shouts the dawn of their commerce and prosperity."
Long before the general festivities took place, and the canal navvies, encouraged by free ale, had worked themselves into a blissful state of euphoria, the local poets had scribbled out their exultant verses, and the ballad writers had penned their celebratory ditties. In some cases, as on the Croydon Canal, the verses were sung by one of the proprietors, but the writer frequently sang his own composition. A particularly prolific balladeer was John Freeth, the Birmingham coffee house owner who wrote many such songs to perform to his customers. When the Birmingham Canal navigation was opened in 1769, John was there with a song at the ready, and perhaps it would be fitting to end this brief excursion into the navvy's world with Freeth's hymn of praise for canals.
"This day for our new navigation, we banish all cares and vexation. The sight of the barges, each honest heart, lads, and the merriest of mortals are Birmingham lads. Birmingham lads, jovial blazon, the merriest of mortals are Birmingham lads. With pride every heart must be glowing. Stamps, presses and lathes shall be going. The lads to the wharf with their lasses repair and smile at the streamers that play in the air.
Play in the air, free and fair, and smile at the streamers that play in the air.
Let Stratford's sons boast out of measure the fruits of their mulberry treasure. Such treasure for once may cause jubilee joys, but riches spring daily from Birmingham toys.
Birmingham toys, all men praise, but riches spring daily from Birmingham toys.
Seven Trent and the Avon, our countrymen frequently rave on, but none of their neighbours are happy as they, who peaceably dwell on the banks of Moray.
Banks of Moray, ever gay, who peaceably dwell on the banks of Moray.
Not Europe can match us for traffic, America, Asia and Africa. Of what we invent, each partakes of a share. For the best of wrought metals is Birmingham ware.
Birmingham ware, none so rare.
For the best of wrought metals is Birmingham ware.
Once the dust had settled on the canal opening celebrations, the real work began. The bargees and their mates, and later the wives and children of the boatmen, with the aid of a horse, floated up and down the canals carrying coal, iron ore, wood, copper, foodstuffs, hardware, and all manner of goods. Those who operated the canal tolls and the boatmen themselves left a wide variety of jobs for the new life, and occasionally the navvies who had excavated the ditches ended their tramping days and lived relatively settled lives as canal boatmen. The companies that owned the canals were usually separate from those that operated the canal carrying business. The canal owners levied tolls of varying amounts depending upon the type of goods, and the carriers charged their customers whatever they thought the market could stand. The canal boatmen practiced various deceptions in order to defraud the company and to supplement their incomes. They would overload boats, cover high toll cargo with low toll goods, obtain the connivance of the toll keepers, and so on. The carriers took various steps to curtail such abuses, and they were quick to prosecute in order to make an example of errant boatmen.
Coventry Canal Navigation. Caution. On Friday the 27th of May instant, Henry Woodward, the steerer of a boat, was brought before the county magistrates at Coventry, charged with endeavouring to evade the toll payable to the Coventry Canal Company in respect of several cases of pipes which he had secreted in his boat laden with roadstone, and was convicted of the offence. This is to give notice that all persons offending in a similar manner will be proceeded against, and the whole penalty of £5 prescribed by the same sued for. And in addition, the whole of the cargo in the boat, although partly consisting of roadstone, will be charged with tonnage. By order, Charles Woodcock, Clerk of the Coventry Canal Company, May the 25th, 1861.
As the 19th century progressed, so the life of the canal folk grew harder. Competition from the railways and the many trade recessions of the early and mid-19th century hit the canal-carrying companies, and inevitably, wage rates failed to keep pace with cost-of-living increases. Often, particularly on the longer hauls, wives and children had to travel with the boats in order to make the life a paying proposition, and the subsequent social problems caused through overcrowding and poor amenities were considerable. Additionally, like many other workers, the canal folk suffered under the truck system that was so popular with employers. Under this system, the boatmen were paid in full or part by tommy notes, which could only be exchanged at the company-owned shop or a shop designated by the company. Thus, the boatmen, like the colliers, iron workers and craft workers, were subject to a singularly destructive payment system. Unlike the colliers, whose reaction was often violent and always militant, and unlike the craft workers whose reaction tended to be submissive and appealing, the canal folk accepted the situation as a fait accompli. They didn't like it very much, but were not prepared to dwell too heavily on their problems. Thus the feeling behind the song Tommy Note is at once humorous, permissive and complaining.
You boatsmen and colliers, all come listen to me, ditty. I'll sing you a song before it's long. It is both new and pretty. It is concerning Tommy's shops and the high-field ruffian. He pays you with a Tommy note. Oh, you must have that or nothing. All the boatsmen I now bring in sail from high fields to Runcan. The boatsmen and their wives, they curse him at the junction, and all belonging to the branch that know the art of boating. Wishing the tiller down his throat, it would be a means to choke him. Now when they've done their Runcorn voyage and go to receive their money, the one half stops for hay and corn and the other half for Tommy. Then to the Tommy shops we'll go to fetch our week's provision, our oatmeal, sugar, salt and soap, short weight and little measure. Oh, if we had money instead of this provision, we could have plenty. The profit that they get out of us is 9 shillings out of 20. And then we jump on board the boat and the children look so funny. The voyage we so cheerful go till we've eaten all our tummy. Now there is one amongst the rest, he knows the art of boating. He vows and swears a wife he'll have so long he's gone a-courting. He vows that he will married be, come listen to me joke, sir. And when the parson's done his work, he'll pay him with a Tommy note, sir. Oh, now that we have finished our voyage, the children look so funny. For here at Runcan we do lie, and we've bet out all our Tommy. Come gear the horse and clear the line, and jump on board the boat, sir. Both night and day we'll steer our way for another Tommy note, sir.